There is something else to be said upon Keplerism and Newtonism. It is a squirm. I fear me that our experiences have sophisticated us. We have noted the division in Keplerism, by which, like everything else that we have examined, it is as truly interpretable one way as it is another way. The squirm. To lose all sense of decency and value of data, but to be agreeable, but to be like everybody else, and intend to turn our agreeableness to profit. To agree with the astronomers that Kepler's three laws are not absolutely true, of course, but are approximations, and that the planets do move, as in Keplerian doctrine they are said to move but then to require only one demonstration that this Earth is one of the planets. To admire Newton's Principia from the beginning to the end of it, having, like almost all other admirers, never even seen a copy of it, to accept every theorem in it, without having the slightest notion what any one of them means, to accept that moving bodies do obey the laws of motion, and must move in one of the conic sections but then to require only one demonstration that this Earth is a moving body. Kepler's three laws are popularly supposed to demonstrate that this Earth moves around the Sun. This is a mistake. There is something wrong with everything that is popular. As was said by us before, except that this Earth is stationary, and Kepler's doctrines apply equally well to a Sun around which proportionately interspaced planets move in ellipses, the whole system moving around a central and stationary Earth. All observations upon the motions of heavenly bodies are in accord with this interpretation of Kepler's laws. Then as to nothing but a quandary, which means that this Earth is stationary, or which means that this Earth is not stationary, just as one pleases, Sir Isaac Newton selected, or pleased himself and others. Without one datum, without one little indication more convincing one way than the other, he preferred to think that this Earth is one of the moving planets. To this degree had he the profundity that we read about. He wrote no books upon the first and second horns of his dilemma, he simply disregarded the dilemma. To anybody who may be controversially inclined, I offer simplification. He may feel at a disadvantage against batteries of integrals and bombardments of quaternions, transcendental functions, conics, and all the other stores of an astronomer's munitions. Admire them. Except that they do apply to the bodies that move around the Sun. Require one demonstration that this Earth is one of those bodies. For treatment of any such demonstration, see our disquisition, or our ratiocinations upon the three abstrusities, or our intolerably painful attempts to write seriously upon the three abstrusities. We began with three screams from an exhilarated mathematician. We have had some doubtful adventures, trying hard to pretend that monsters, or little difficulties, did really oppose us. We have reached, not the heart of a system, but the crotch of quandary. 11. We have seen that some of the most brilliant inspirations of godlike intellects, or some of the most pestilential emanations from infected minds, have been attempts to account for the virtual changelessness of the stars. Above all other data of astronomy, that virtual changelessness of position stands out as a crucial circumstance in my own mind. To account for constellations that have not changed in 2,000 years, astronomers say that they conceive of inconceivable distances. We shall have expressions of our own upon the virtually changeless positions of the stars, but there will be difficulties for us if the astronomers ever have found that some stars move around or with other stars. I shall take up the story of Professor Struve and the companion of Procyon, with more detail, for the sake of some more light upon refinement, exactness, accuracy in astronomy, and for the sake of belittling, or for the sake of sneering, or anything else that anybody may choose to call it. Professor Struve's announcement of his discovery of the companion of Procyon is published in Monthly Notices, 33-430 that, upon the 19th of March, 1873, Struve had discovered the companion of Procyon, having compared it micrometrically, having tested his observations with three determinations of position angle, three measures of distance, and three additional determinations of position angle, finding all in excellent agreement. No optical illusion could be possible, it is said, because another astronomer, Lindemann, had seen the object. Technically, Struve publishes a table of his observations, side real time, distances, position angles, from March 19 to April 2, 1873, after which his observations had to be discontinued until the following year. In monthly notices, 34 to 355, are published the resumed observations. Struve says that Ahlers would not accept the discovery, unless, in the year that had elapsed, the companion had shown increase in position, consistent with theory. Struve writes this increase has really shown itself in the most remarkable manner. Therefore, he considers it decisively established that the object of his observations was the object of Ahlers' calculations. He says that Seresky, of Moscow, had seen the companion, without being warned of the place where it was to be looked for. However, see back some chapters. It may be said that, nevertheless, other stars have companions that do move as they should move. Later we shall consider this subject, thinking that it may be that lights have been seen to change position near some stars, but that never has a star revolved around another star, as to fit paleoastronomic theory it should. I take for a basis of analogy that never has one sat in a park and watched a tree revolve around one, but that given the affliction, or the endowment, of an astronomer, illusion of such a revolution one may have. We sit in a park. We notice a tree. Wherever we get the notion, we do have the notion that the tree has moved. Then, farther along, we notice another tree, and, as an indication of our vivid imagination or something else, we think it is the same tree, farther along. After that we pick out tree after tree, farther along, and, convinced that it is the same tree, of course conclude that the thing is revolving around us. Exactness and refinement develop, we compute the elements of its orbit. We close our eyes and predict where the tree will be when next we look, and there, by the same process of selection and identification, it is where it should be. And if we have something of almost everybody's mania for speed, we make that damn thing spin around with such velocity that we, too, reel in a chaos of very much unsettled botanic conventions. There is nothing far-fetched in this analogy, except the factor of velocity. Goldschmidt did announce that there were half a dozen faint points of light around Sirius, and it was Dawes' suspicion that Clark had arbitrarily picked out one of them. It is our expression that all around Sirius, at various distances from Sirius, faint points of light were seen, and that at first, even for the first 16 years, astronomers were not thoroughly hypnotized, and would not pick out the especial point of light that they should have picked out, so that there was nothing like agreement between the calculated and the observed orbit. Besides the irreconcilable observations noted by Flammarion, see the Intel. OBS, 1-482, 4 others. Then came standardized seeing. So, in the observatory, 20-73, is published a set of observations, in the year 1896, upon the companion of Sirius, placing it exactly where it should be. Nevertheless, under this set of observations is published another set, so different that the editor asks, does this mean that there are two companions? Dark companions require a little more eliminative treatment. So the variable nebulae, then, and do dark nebulae revolve around light nebulae? For instances of variable nebulae, see MEMS. RAS, 49-214, Comptes Rendus, 59-637, Monthly Notices, 38-104. It may be said that they are not of the Algol type. Neither is Algol, we have shown. According to the compulsions of data, our idea is that the stars that seem to be fixed in position are fixed in position, so now proper motion is as irreconcilable to us as relative motions. As to proper motion, the situation is this. The stars that were catalogued 2,000 years ago have virtually not changed, or, if there be refinement in modern astronomy, have changed no more than a little more nearly exact charting would account for, but, in astronomic theory, the stars are said to be thought of as flying apart at unthinkable velocity, so then evidence of changed positions of stars is welcome to astronomers. As to well-known constellations, it cannot be said that there has been change, so, With several exceptions, proper motion is attributed to stars that are not well known. The result is an amusing trap. Great proper motion is said to indicate relative nearness to this Earth. Of the 25 stars of supposed greatest proper motion, all but two are faintest of stars, so these 23 are said to be nearest this Earth. But when astronomers take the relative parallax of a star, by reference to a fainter star, they agree that the fainter star, because fainter, is farther away. So one-time faintness associates with nearness, and then conveniences change, and faintness associates with farness, and the whole subject so associates with humorousness, that if we're going to be serious at all in these expressions of ours, we had better pass on. Observatory, March, 1914. A group of three stars that disappeared. If three stars disappeared at once, they were acted upon by something that affected all in common. Try to think of some one force that would not tear the seeable into visible rags, that could blot out three stars, if they were trillions of miles apart. If they were close together, that ends the explanation that only because stars are trillions of miles apart have they, for at least 2,000 years, seemed to hold the same relative positions.